in singing that song, it made me think about that I could just take that song and preach a lesson. It's one that, as we sing the words, I hope we are truthful with one another and with ourselves. The very first line, I'm satisfied with just a cottage below. Are we really? We sometimes go through this life seemingly building and adding on and building and wanting more. And we think that the purpose of our life is to die with the best looking house on the block. And while there's nothing wrong with having a nice house, that should not be our pursuit. And I hope we are satisfied with just that cottage. And there might be some that say, well, if that's what I had to do, I'd be willing to do that. Well, given the opportunity, I hope we would make the sacrifices necessary to serve God above all. I hope that's the case. I'm not going to go through the rest of the song, but just go through that song in your mind, and there's a lesson for you. A great song. Appreciate Travis leading that. Of course, when we're thinking about mansions, we're not hopefully in our minds thinking about we're going to be like the Beverly Hillbillies and the finest house that there ever was, and we'll just have that life of ease. We're going to go to heaven to be servants, and I don't know exactly what that'll be like. I don't believe any of us do. If the Apostle Paul says we don't know yet what we will be like, then I'm sure that we can't know right now. But what we do know is we'll be with our God, and we will be servants before Him for eternity, blessed by Him. And that's in singing about mansions. That's what we're looking forward to. I want to say before we get into this morning's lesson, just a word about our drill class tonight. For those who may not have been here the last drill class, we're going to go back tonight and look at some of the kings. We're beginning in this quarter to talk about the major prophets, and those prophets are set in the time of the divided kingdom and on into the time when they're taken away into captivity. But at the beginning of Isaiah, what many of us looked at this morning, in the beginning of Jeremiah, in Ezekiel, there won't be names of the kings of Judah mentioned, but there will be kings given. So I want us to go through and be reminded of that. So for the drill class tonight, young people, go over your list of kings, both of Judah and Israel, and we're going to discuss that for our drill class this evening. I have the text for our lesson up on the whiteboard this morning. We're going to be looking at a passage in Matthew chapter 12 and verses 1 through 8, a passage that many have given various commentary on, have different ideas about what is taking place here, what Jesus is teaching in His response to the Pharisees' condemnation of His disciples. I want us just to begin there in Matthew 12, 1 and read through and just observe some things. I think sometimes we come to a passage such as this where there might be some controversy over a particular point, and we spend so much time trying to figure out that controversy that we lose sight of some other very important things that are seen or should be seen in that text. So I want us to try to examine all of it this morning and gain a better understanding of who Jesus is, of who we should be as His disciples. Beginning in verse 1, Matthew chapter 12, it tells us at that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and His disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. And when the Pharisees saw it, they said to Him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." We begin here to see how the Pharisees treated Jesus throughout His public ministry. This wasn't an isolated occasion where the Pharisees found some fault in Jesus, and in this passage, His disciples, which would then be transferred to Jesus, they were constantly trying to find fault with Him. From the time that Jesus began His work, His focus was entirely on doing the will of His Father and doing everything that He could in trying to help others see that they needed to join Him in doing the will of His Father. It wasn't something that Jesus just began to do when he was 30 years of age and he was baptized and he began that public ministry. This was something that he had always done. We find in Luke chapter 2, when Jesus was found in the temple by his mother after searching anxiously for him, his response was, "Did you not know that I must be about my Father's business?" That was at 12 years of age. Jesus understood his purpose in this life was to do his Father's will. And that's what he constantly sought to do. When his public work did begin, he began to draw a lot of attention to himself. Not that he was trying to somehow be puffed up, to raise himself up above others. It was just the nature of his work and his teaching that drew people to him. If we had someone today who had the love and the compassion and did the good works that Jesus did, I have no doubt there'd be a lot of people who would be drawn to that type of individual. We see in Matthew chapter 4, in verses 23 through 25, that as Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing all kinds of sickness and all kinds of disease among the people, his fame went throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all sick people who were afflicted with various diseases and torments, and those who were demon-possessed, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. And great multitudes followed him from Galilee, from Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and beyond the Jordan. And so we see he was very popular among the people for his teachings and for his work. Well, that brought about some envy on the part of some. You know, there are others who had been teaching. There are others who had been seeking an opportunity to be some sort of a leader among the Jews, and they didn't have this type of response. People weren't following them like they did Jesus. And so we have the Pharisees, who, along with some of the other Jewish leaders, who were envious and constantly seeking an opportunity to destroy Jesus. In Matthew chapter 27 and verse 18, Pilate, who was not a very religious man, not a very good man, but even he recognized that Jesus was handed over, not because he was a lawbreaker, not because he had even violated some Jewish law that he wasn't really interested in upholding, but he understood that Jesus was handed over because of envy. And it was envy, it was jealousy that led the Pharisees to constantly look for and try to find opportunities to catch Jesus in something. We notice very early in Jesus' work, in the book of Mark, chapter 3, Mark moves very fast. In fact, the story that we're looking at in Matthew chapter 12 this morning, that's recorded in Mark chapter 2. Mark moves very fast. So it's the third chapter. That doesn't mean it's one of the very first things that happened because Mark moved so quickly, but this was early in the ministry of Jesus. He's still up there in Galilee. We see here in chapter 13, he's going to call the 12 apostles. So, you know, this is early. But notice what you see in verse 6. Then the Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against him how they might destroy him. That's what they wanted to do. That's the opportunity that they're looking for. You wonder, as Jesus here in Matthew 12 and his disciples are on the Sabbath, walking through the grain field, where did the Pharisees come from? You know, it's not as if they're standing in the marketplace in some public arena. They're off by themselves, walking through a grain field, but then the Pharisees pop up. Oh, what are your disciples? What are they doing? They're following. They're close to Jesus, but they're close for the wrong reason. They're looking for opportunities to condemn him. And there are people like that today, people who will stay close, people who will give attention to the followers of Christ. But they're not there for the right reasons. They're not there trying to learn. They're not trying to grow closer to God, but they're looking to find fault with others. Maybe they too are filled with envy because someone has somewhat of a following. And I don't mean any kind of unscriptural thing, but because of a work that a man or woman does, sometimes they draw the interest of others. Good people tend to do that with other good people. But there are those who are still envious of that type of thing. Are always there, and they're looking, and they're trying to find something for which to condemn others. Hopefully that doesn't describe us. There are two things that the Pharisees seem to be focused on in the life of Jesus that they always seem to come back to and draw attention to. The thing that they think of, in one of these two areas, we can catch them. There were others beside these, but these seem to be the two greatest. One was his claim to be the Son of God. That was blasphemy. And that will be the thing that they finally, in accusing Jesus there the night he's betrayed, that'll be the charge levied against him. He makes himself out to be the Son of God. The other thing that came up again and again was Jesus' violation of the Sabbath. In the minds of the scribes and the Pharisees, the religious leaders, it seemed to very often surround the keeping of the Sabbath, whether Jesus was healing on the Sabbath, or like this occasion where his disciples were plucking the heads of grain. There's something about the Sabbath day that they're going to try to accuse him of. And that's true on this occasion. On the surface, these two concerns might seem to be legitimate. Don't you think it would be good to be aware of blasphemy? And if we saw anyone who seemed to be claiming to be someone or something that would elevate themselves to equality with God, is that not something that would pique our interest, that make us stand up and take attention, pay attention? It should. And if someone were violating the Sabbath day was not something to be taken lightly. We're going to see in just a little bit. It was something for the Jews to take very serious. And so on the surface, these would be concerns that good Jewish people would give attention to it. If they saw someone possibly violating either of these things, that they would be right in calling attention to that. But an honest look at the facts, an honest look at what the Pharisees and the other religious leaders were doing, would see that they weren't being honest. Yes, someone who claimed to be God would draw attention. But if you did what Jesus did, if you spoke like Jesus spoke, then we wouldn't be so quick to condemn. In John chapter 3, there was a man who came to Jesus in verses 1 and 2. We know him by the name Nicodemus. Do you also know he was a Pharisee? Do you also know at the end of the book of John, we find that he, along with Joseph of Arimathea, took Jesus' body and buried it? If you were an honest Pharisee, then you'd be like Nicodemus. And what Nicodemus said to Jesus is, Jesus, we know that you are a man from God because no one could do the things that you do unless he was from God. And so, yeah, the claim to be the Son of God would be unbelievable, maybe. But so was Jesus. And so if they really were interested in the things of God, they would have looked closely at Jesus' claims that he was the Son of God. Jesus wasn't the only one being scrutinized. As we see in verse 2, it was when the Pharisees saw the action of the disciples that they say to Jesus, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. And that's what we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about this morning. Before we get into verses 3 through 8, I want us to just think about the fact that there are still people in the world today who do not believe that Jesus is the Son of God. They do not believe that Jesus died on the cross. They do not believe that Jesus offers now forgiveness of sins for those who would follow him. And they would do anything and everything they can to destroy him. And just like these Pharisees, maybe they're looking for things in Jesus himself, but they will also look to Jesus' disciples in order to discredit Jesus. We are Jesus' disciples today. we are being scrutinized by people of the world. They will make decisions about Jesus based on what we, as those who claim to be his followers, do or don't do. And yes, we will be falsely accused at times, like Jesus' disciples were here. But please don't ever let there be any true accusation made. And if there is, I know we're not perfect, and we will fall short of the example that Jesus set before us. But if that time ever comes, or when that time comes, let's own up to it. Let's let people know that, yes, that's what I did, but Jesus would not approve, does not approve, and I'm sorry for that, and I want to make things right. Whether we're dealing with our neighbors, whether we're dealing with the people in the public sector, whether working with people down at the DMV, which is hard to do sometimes, we are followers of Christ. Let's act like it. Let's don't give them any reason to discredit our Lord based on our actions. But the Pharisees do. And so Jesus takes this opportunity to not only instruct the Pharisees, but his disciples and all who would read this story. It begins in verse 3. Have you not read? Jesus defends his disciples, and he doesn't defend them just because they are his disciples. He defends them because they're innocent. He defends them because not only they, but he and really in a sense God himself are ones being tried here. You would think that there might be some who, because a friend, an acquaintance here, a disciple has been condemned, maybe if we give them that pound of flesh, you know, give them something, maybe that will deter them. But Jesus wasn't going to do that. He wasn't willing to sacrifice his disciples that way. And Jesus' disciples can always trust that Jesus, their master, will defend them. You remember Satan as he stood before God in the book of Job chapter 1 when God commends Job to him. Satan accuses him. No, Job's not loyal to you. Job only serves you because he's so blessed. Well, God defended Job on that occasion. He gave Job the opportunity to defend himself, and we can be certain that God, that our Lord Jesus will do the same for us today. He will defend us. There are many theories concerning the next few verses and what Jesus says. We don't want to consider those theories. I'm not going to go through and give you all the different ideas that are out there. What we're going to do is look at what the Scriptures have to say. And on an issue, that's what we want to do. You know, when oftentimes someone's accused, they'll just begin trying to reason with someone. But doesn't it seem reasonable that someone should do this, that? And maybe it is reasonable, but that's not a basis for our following God. That's not a basis for anything that we do. We want to have Scripture. And when we have Scripture to offer as evidence, that's when we can have faith in our actions and the actions of others. So when Jesus says, have you not read, let us be reminded that that should always be where we start with people in trying to understand anything for ourselves or in trying to teach others. Let's look to what the Scriptures say. Have you not read what? Well, have you not read what David did when he was hungry, he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who were with him, but only for the priest. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priest in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Yet I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. We're going to get to the passage, the two passages that Jesus is referencing here with David and the priest. But there are a couple of others that I want us to look to begin with that will help in our understanding what's taking place. The first is in Exodus chapter 20. And this is one we could just state. You know, everybody kind of knows this. That's good to do at times, but at times it's good to just turn and look. Sometimes we get too comfortable with everybody kind of knows this and forget the fact there are a lot of people who don't. So let's turn to Exodus chapter 20 and let's read verses 8 through 11. This is at Mount Sinai as the Lord spoke from the mountain to the people who were gathered around giving what we call the Ten Commandments here. Verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gate. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. And we could turn over to the book of Deuteronomy and we could read really the very same thing. And sometimes we'd be tempted, and I'm tempted this morning just to say it's the same thing. We don't need to turn and even give any consideration to it. But I would just like you to consider this. 40 years later, after the people who rejected God's law, after they rejected God's guidance and leadership, after they've all died off in the wilderness, there's another generation that arises. And you will notice that in Deuteronomy chapter 4, as Moses recounts the law doesn't change. We might be tempted in a situation like that to see that, well, none of those people, except for two, Joshua and Caleb, were able to follow the Lord the first time he tried to bring them into the land. There must be something wrong with the law, so therefore let's tweak the law a little bit. Let's change it up. Let's maybe make it a little easier, a little more accommodating to the people. And then you could have people who would follow you. God did not do that. God never compromised his law. When he gave his law, that law remained. And it was never pushed out of the way. It was never covered up. It was never belittled in order to make the people seem more righteous. You know, that happens. It happens today. We don't like to call sin, sin. Sometimes I'll even use in my language, you know, somebody made a mistake. And I hope you don't think that I'm trying to trivialize that thing. Even in calling something a mistake, I hope we realize that oftentimes that means sin. But God's law doesn't change. We're not going to take time this morning. I do feel like I need to say, because we're talking about the violation of the Sabbath law, the covenant changed. The mediator of the covenant changed. The parameters of the covenant have changed. We are under the law of Christ today. We're not Jews. We didn't receive that law at Mount Sinai. And so, yes, there is a change of law because there is a change of mediator, because the whole system has changed. It's no longer just for the Jews. And so in that sense, yes, the law changed, but God's law in general does not change. It does not change because people can't or won't keep the law. But we'll look at a few other passages. Look in Numbers chapter 15. Was God serious when he said keep the Sabbath day? Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy? Well, in Numbers chapter 15, that's put to the test. There's a man found gathering sticks, beginning in verse 32. When they found that man, they brought him to Moses and they wanted to know what should we do with him. And notice that they don't just have a convenience of a council here and take the majority vote. In verse 35, the Lord said to Moses. The Lord gave instructions. They looked to the Lord for wanting to know what to do. And what did the Lord say? The man must surely be put to death. You think God was serious about remembering the Sabbath day to keep it holy? Absolutely he was. And the penalty, the violation for that would be death. That's what you could expect if you violated that command. If you look over in Exodus chapter 35, there are a couple of other things here that we need to be mindful of. we read in Exodus chapter 20, no work should be done. But what constitutes work? And what exactly could you or could you not do? Well, it's interesting that if you read through the law, you don't find a lot of details given. Now, there are some, but you don't find a lot of them. And I think the idea that God is showing through the absence of all those details is, you know what's work and you know what's not work. You can figure that out. But he is more specific in a couple of areas, and Exodus chapter 35 is one of them. In verse 3, he says, you shall kindle no fire throughout your dwellings on the Sabbath day. Now, I don't know what that man in Numbers chapter 15 was going to do with those sticks, gathering sticks, but I suspect strongly that that's probably what he intended to do, was to kindle a fire with them. But here, they're told, don't kindle a fire. Well, you know what you couldn't do without fire in your dwelling place? You couldn't cook. And specific information is given concerning that back in Exodus chapter 16, in verse 23. Then he said to them, this is what the Lord has said, tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, and boil what you will boil. Lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. This is when God had given manna from heaven. They were to go out and gather it in 6 days. The sixth day, they were to gather enough for 2 days because they weren't even to gather the manna on the seventh day. And here, they're told that they couldn't cook with it on the Sabbath day. They couldn't bake or boil. They were to do that ahead of time. Now, they could eat it, but they couldn't prepare it on the Sabbath day. So similar to what we read over there in chapter 35, there wasn't to be any cooking or preparing of meals on the Sabbath. That was to be done ahead of time. So the Jews were to remember the Sabbath day and to keep it holy. Nobody's arguing that. When Jesus goes on to defend his disciples, he's not going to argue against that law and say that somehow God has relaxed the rules concerning the Sabbath day, because there had been 1,500 years since the time that law was given. No, he's not going to do that. I want you to see another passage in the book of Deuteronomy that relates to the story, not specifically about keeping the Sabbath day, but it does relate to what people would understand about keeping the Sabbath day, and it would help us to also see some things about what was going on in our story, Matthew chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 23, we'll read verses 24 and 25. When you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes at your pleasure, but you shall not put any in your container. And this would be the most applicable part here in verse 25. When you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not use a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain. So those are two interesting laws. They're laws that God gave to provide for those who were hungry. So if you were walking through your neighbor's grain field, if you're walking through their vineyard, and presumably, if you're walking through their cucumber patch, their melon field, you know, wherever you are, that you could eat the food that was found in that field. You could pluck it off and you could eat it, but you couldn't gather. You couldn't take baskets in there with you and gather a good crop of grapes and take those home and put them. You couldn't go through with a sickle and gather the wheat, though you could pluck the heads of grain. What does that have to do with the story? Well, number one, God shows that there is a distinction to be made between gathering and eating. If you saw a man out in your field who was just eating from what was out there to fill his stomach, that was lawful and that was to be allowed. Nothing was to be done to that man. However, if there was a man with a sickle going through and cutting the grain, well, that would be unlawful. That would be stealing. And that person then would be dealt with. You see, there's a difference between the work of gathering and the if you wanted to call it a work, and that of eating. God showed that there was a difference in those two things. So when you think about the story here in Matthew chapter 12 and the accusation made that your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath, based on whose law? God's law concerning the Sabbath said that a man was not supposed to kindle a fire. A man was not supposed to bake or boil anything. He's not to cook that food on the Sabbath. But he could eat it. He could pick it up off the plate and he could put it in his mouth. And as we see the command given there in Deuteronomy 23, you're walking through the grain field and plucking. To pluck was different than to put in the sickle. It was different to winnow. To winnow the grain after it's been beaten, to blow away the chaff. If you rub the grain in your hands and you blow away the chaff, you're not winnowing. You're not doing work in eating that grain. But let's just suppose for a moment that it was. It's interesting when Jesus answers these Pharisees. I've wondered before. Why doesn't Jesus just turn to the, when he says, have you not read, why not turn to Exodus 20? Why not turn to Exodus 23 and Deuteronomy 4 and Numbers chapter 50? Why not go to those passages and show, look guys, you know, I understand that you're mindful of the law and you're wanting to make sure, but that they haven't violated anything, and let's prove why they haven't. Why didn't Jesus do that? Well, I think the answer is what we see in Matthew chapter 5 when Jesus says, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of God. I think we see it in Matthew chapter 23 when Jesus again and again and again refers to the Pharisees as hypocrites. He's wanting to here point out their hypocrisy. If they were truly interested in the keeping of the law, and they were truly interested in keeping the law themselves, I tell you how the story would go. It wouldn't be that the Pharisees saw Jesus' disciples plucking the heads of grain and coming and complaining to Jesus, why are your disciples doing what's not lawful? Do you know why the disciples were plucking the heads of grain? The text tells us they were hungry. And I suspect they were mightily hungry. We've got grain that grows around us sometimes, and I look out there and I think, oh, that's so pretty, especially after it dries and you got the golden grain and the sunrise comes up in the east behind our house. Oh, it's beautiful out there. But I've never looked out of that field and looked at that grain and thought, oh, that looks so delicious. I think I'd love to go out there and just get a handful of that raw grain and taste it. I bet it's just scrumptious. It's not. But if you were hungry, you'd eat it. You know, they're hungry. So if you saw someone who's hungry and they're about to violate God's law, what would a true follower of Christ, or in this, what would a Jew who was really concerned about keeping God's law, what would he do? Hey guys, I'm not sure about what you're, I'm not sure that wouldn't be in some ways considered work. But I'll tell you what, I know you're hungry. I've got some food at the house. Why don't y'all come home with me? It's already been prepared. We prepared it yesterday. There's no work going to go into it. But you can come back with us and we'll feed you. If they were truly sincere in their accusation, I have no doubt that the story would have played out something like that. But they're not sincere. Which is why Jesus doesn't just simply explain to them the law and why that they're incorrect of the way that they're applying the law. He wants to point out to them and to others what's really going on here. So in verse 4, have you not read how David and those who were hungry, so you got a similar situation, they're hungry. He entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which was not lawful for him to eat. If we go back and look in 1 Samuel chapter 21, we'll find that David did just that. Now, we're not told that he entered the house of the Lord. I don't think that Jesus is incorrect in the way he's retelling the story here. But he enters, he goes, and he eats the showbread, which was not lawful for anyone but the priest. Now, that's not just the way, you know, the Pharisees viewed things. That was the law that had been given. In Leviticus chapter 24, in giving the instructions concerning the priest and how they were to care for things. In verse 5 of Leviticus 24, and you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2/10 of an ephah shall be in each cake. You shall set them in two rows, six in a row, on the pure gold table before the Lord. And you shall put frankincense on each row, that it may be on the bread for a memorial, an offering made by fire to the Lord. Every Sabbath he shall set it in order before the Lord continually, being taken from the children of Israel by an everlasting covenant. And it shall be for Aaron and his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place. For it is most holy to him from the offerings of the Lord made by fire, by a perpetual statute. We could look in Numbers 28 as well to see that it was for the priest. So what Jesus says concerning David and what David did, which was not lawful, that was true. It was a violation of the law. Why did Jesus use this example? Was he just joining the Pharisees in their pursuit of finding lawbreakers? You know, let's go back and let's scrutinize and let's find everybody who violated. Let's just start with David. He violated the Lord's law. No, I don't think that was it. Was he looking for others who were guilty in order to justify his disciples? You know, sometimes we do that. Somebody brings up a true accusation, something that really has merit to it, and rather than dealing with that, we want to jump to, well, let's look and, you know, see what so-and-so others did. Was Jesus just doing that? You say everybody's guilty. I hear it very often in regards to authority. You know, we have to have authority for what we do. Yeah, but we all do things that we don't have authority for. Well, if that's the case, let's don't do things. Let's don't do all those things. But that doesn't justify anything. That's not what Jesus is trying to do. Was he establishing a law of situation ethics, which is what a lot of people say concerning this passage? That yes, David violated the law. He did what was not lawful, but he had good reason for it. And so long as you have good reason for it, then you can violate God's law. No, that's not what Jesus is doing. How can we be sure on that point? I'll give you one example. You know, people, you talk about situation ethics. What is the situation that would make it okay to violate God's law? What if your life was at stake? Life or death type of situation. Would that be okay then to do what was not lawful? I'll tell you, through three guys that did not think so. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If it were a matter of situational ethics, if you're put in a situation where your life is at stake, then surely God would understand why you didn't keep his law. And we could bow down, and in our minds, we know we're not going to worship this image. We know, and we'll even tell other people around, there's nothing to this. But in that case, they were willing to die for what was right. You know, look at Jesus' own disciples as they go out. Each of them died for their faith. Each of them died for doing what the Lord commanded them to do. They didn't find situations that demanded that they bend rules. And if someone wants to use an occasion like David, if they say that, okay, you know, Jesus, he's telling it's unlawful, but he's saying that it was justified, then if you want to have a situation that you're going to try to justify on the basis of that, then it needs to be like that situation. You know, somebody that is on the run for his life, somebody who is not just, you know, he's got a little hunger, he didn't eat breakfast this morning, and, you know, I need a little something to fill my belly. You know, someone who is destitute of food, someone who has no other means to get any food. He can't go to his neighbors, he can't go anywhere, the king's looking for him. You find a situation like that, and you want to then try to justify doing something that ordinarily maybe you didn't do, then we could even talk about that maybe. But the things that are brought up nowadays to try to put in to the place of this story and say, well, we can do it based on this. It needs to be a similar story. But I think as we go through, Jesus, he's not doing that. The Pharisees knew this story. When he says, have you not read? The answer is yes, they have read. And they would remember well the stories of David. And the Pharisees' knowledge of David's story really gets to the heart of the problem. When Jesus, as I mentioned in Matthew 5 and 23, talks about their hypocrisy, the story illustrates their hypocrisy. They had never thought to condemn David for his actions. They might be among those that say he was justified in taking that bread and eating it. But for Jesus, you got David, who was something, a clear violation of God's will, we're going to overlook or justify, but Jesus and his disciples, then we're going to try to destroy them because of it. And as I said, if they're truly interested in carrying out God's law, the entirety of it, then they would have tried to help the disciples in their hunger rather than to condemn them. And then in verse 5, have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? Again, you know, profaning the Sabbath. We read in Leviticus 24 that it was on the Sabbath day they were to bake that bread. There were offerings that were to be made on the Sabbath day, the daily offerings, and then there were other offerings that were to be made specifically on the Sabbath day. God had given that command. So when Jesus says that they profane the Sabbath, he's using accommodative language here. They could not profane something in a way that God had, in doing something that God had commanded. But in applying the Pharisees' logic and their rules, well, that's what the priest would be doing. They'd be profaning the Sabbath. Jesus, when he's accused of healing on the Sabbath and somehow violating the Sabbath by working, he will point to the fact, was it right to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy on the Sabbath? Well, as this same passage shows on down in verse 11, after they've accused him of doing what was not lawful on the Sabbath, Jesus says, what man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out? Or how much more valued is a man than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And those priests were doing good. They weren't profaning the Sabbath. And here, I think he's just showing how if you want to take your rules and your laws and you want to apply them evenly to all men, then you need to go get the priest because they're violating God's law. But they weren't interested in applying what they had determined to anyone else. They only wanted to apply it to Jesus, which is another lesson we need to learn. We're very good at applying rules to other people. We're very good at trying to find some fault in others, and we're going to apply to the strictest sense law, even things that we've contrived in our mind, when we wouldn't apply those same standards to ourselves. We wouldn't apply those same standards to people we love. But that's what the Pharisees were doing. And Jesus, again, I believe here, is showing their hypocrisy. So you let the priest do their job in the temple because you understand that's right. But he says in verse 6, I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. And if you think those priests, by doing what you would consider to be unlawful or profaning the Sabbath, profaning even the temple, what were they doing to Christ, one who was greater than the temple? Then verse 7, if you had known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would have not condemned the guiltless. Another verse that I think has been abused. Jesus is not saying, throw sacrifice out the window. What I want is mercy. Get rid of the sacrifice. No, God wanted the sacrifices. He commanded the sacrifices. In Matthew 23, we mentioned it a couple of times. Let's turn over there and I want to look at just one section. In verse 23, Jesus says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. A very similar statement to what he makes back there in Matthew 12. You're doing one thing and you're neglecting the other. You're all about these sacrifices and you give no thought to justice and mercy. But so there would be some who'd say, you need to quit nitpicking. You need to quit being so careful about law and just be merciful. But notice Jesus says here in verse 23, as he continues on, these you ought to have done. The tithing of mint and anise and cumin, those small things, Jesus isn't saying you shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't be so concerned about those things. He says, no, you need to do that, but you don't need to leave the others undone. They're more important. And that's what he says back here in Matthew 12, in verse 7. I desire mercy and not sacrifice. He wanted the sacrifice, but above all, he wanted to see mercy and justice. And someone who had a true love for mercy and justice in God, they would give the right types of sacrifice. And then verse 8, for the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. And again, another abused verse. Some attitude may be that, well, if Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath, he can do what he wants to on the Sabbath. And how dare you condemn him? Be like the king who makes the law, he violates that law. Well, that's the king. He made the law. He can keep it or not keep it. He kept that. Or he made the law, so he can do what he wants to. And some believe that that's what Jesus is saying. Who made the Sabbath? In the other accounts, in Mark chapter 2 and Luke chapter 6, there are some other details that will be added, and one of which is the Sabbath is made for man and not man for the Sabbath. What is meant in that statement? They weren't to be punished somehow with the Sabbath. The Sabbath was to be a blessing to the people. But the thing I want us to think about just for a moment, the Sabbath was made for man. The Sabbath was created. Who created it? Jesus. God. There are some things, if you read the rabbinical literature concerning the Sabbath, there's all kinds of thoughts and ideas, rules and regulations. Some of it, you can tell just by reading it, it's just a bunch of gibberish. There's nothing to what these men have written. But I tell you who does know it. Inside and out, backwards and forward. If you've got a question about the Sabbath law, I know who can answer it. Jesus could. He knew what was lawful. He knew what was right. He knew what had been a violation. And if his disciples had been violating the Sabbath by plucking those heads of grain, you know who would have brought it to their attention? Jesus Christ. And so when he says the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath, Jesus knows what he's talking about. Let's listen to him. Let's make sure to follow what he says and not look to our own reasonings and understanding. And there's so many ways that we can apply that in our life today. I recognize that we don't have a Sabbath today. And again, we're not going to go into great depths to prove that this morning. If you have questions about that, I'd be glad to study it with you. But we don't have a Sabbath, and so the particulars of this story really aren't relevant to us in that way. But the way we treat others, the way we follow our Lord, the dedication that is shown in the disciples, that they're willing to continue with him even in those times of hunger, the way that the Pharisees failed to really keep the law as God intended it, all of that applies to us. And I hope that we will learn the lesson that Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. Jesus is Lord of all. He's Lord of our life. And as our Maker, do we not look to him for guidance in how we should live and what we should do? Let's don't be like the Pharisees. Let's don't be like those who are constantly looking for fault, constantly trying to find something wrong with what someone else is doing. If we see it, are we wanting to condemn or are we wanting to save? What is our purpose? Jesus' purpose in Luke 9 was to save, not destroy. And that should be ours as well. Let's help our brethren. Let's help one another. Let's help the lost get to heaven, not trying to strike them down. And recognizing that Jesus is Lord, why won't you submit to him if you haven't already? In Luke chapter 6 and verse 46, Jesus asked the question, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do the things which I say? if we recognize the teachings of Christ, and they're not hard to see, and they're not hard to follow, but we recognize that we're not keeping them, then understand what that means. It means Jesus is not your Lord. He is not your master. And if he's not your Lord, he's not your Savior, because he has to be both. If there's a way that we can help you this morning to come to know who Jesus is so that you would submit to him, then give us the opportunity to study with you. If you know what you're supposed to do and you haven't done it, then repent of your sin while you have the time, before it's too late. Or if you're not a child of God and you want to put on Christ in baptism, the water's ready this morning and we'd be glad to assist you. And if we can help you in any of those ways, would you come and let us know while together we stand and sing.